We've all heard these ads.
This is Humira helping to relieve my pain and protect my joints from further damage.
For my type of chronic dry eye, over-the-counter drops aren't enough. So I also use what I prescribe for many of my patients, Restasis.
That's why you should ask your doctor about Diovan. Diovan relaxes and widens blood vessels, allowing blood to flow more easily, reducing your blood pressure.
But the big question is, how much have you spent on prescription drugs? According to a 2017 survey by Consumer Reports, more than half of American adults regularly take a prescription medication. So what's the average cost per year?
$1,433.
And many of you, our listeners, say the crunch of paying for prescriptions is real.
My name is Susan. My husband has Parkinson's. Our drug bill costs at least $500 a month, sometimes more. We don't do vacations anymore.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth, and I'm calling from Oakland, California. It cost me about two-thirds of my Social Security check. One drug I get from the manufacturer, the copay on that would be about $3,000 per month. I spend $1,100 of my $1,660 Social Security check just on insurance and copays for drugs.
My name is Susan. I am on Social Security. I'm from Spartanburg, South Carolina. My monthly prescription costs are an average of $467 a month. I don't know how I'm going to be able to pay that cost.
It's a decades-long problem in the United States, but under a Trump presidency, things were supposed to change.
My administration is launching the most sweeping action in history to lower the price of prescription drugs for the American people. We've wanted to be doing this. We've been working on it right from day one.
That was the president back in May. Here he is again in October, right before the midterms.
We're fighting for lower drug prices, which will now be automatic. It will be automatic and very substantial.
After raising prices in the first half of 2018, the pharmaceutical drug industry got heat from the Trump administration. And in the second half of 2018, there was a self-imposed pause by some of these companies to halt price increases. But in 2019, it seems they're reversing course. According to a Reuters investigation, at least 28 pharmaceutical companies are expected to increase the price of more than 250 drugs this year. And that leaves Americans spending more on prescription medications than any other wealthy country. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we begin The Takeaway. Here to help us explain what this means for American consumers and the political fight to control prescription drug prices are Zach Carter, a senior reporter with the Huffington Post, and Craig Garthwaite, a strategy professor and the director of healthcare at the Kellogg School of Management. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So, Craig, let's get started with you. We just mentioned in the segment that Americans pay more for drugs than almost any other wealthy country. How did we get to this point?
Well, as a country, we've decided that we're not going to directly try and use our market power to drive down the price we pay for drugs. And I think it's a reasoned political calculus that we worry about providing the appropriate incentives to develop new drugs in the future. And that we think this innovation is really beneficial to society. Other countries have made a different choice. And frankly, their choice is made easier by the fact that the United States is effectively willing to fund innovation for the entire world. And so they can effectively free ride on the money that the United States spends on drugs.
No, we're doing that research, though, and Americans are paying for it, essentially, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not a great situation. I think it's better than the situation where no one pays for it. And that's my worry about sort of the United States pulling back a lot on drug pricing, is that if those profits go away, we really diminish the incentives for future products that will treat conditions for which there are currently no options. And so we're trading off sort of access today where people have to pay high prices, so maybe they don't get all the drugs they want today, in order to create access in the future for new treatment options. So people who have pancreatic cancer or other horrible conditions today that are effectively death sentences, we want to provide the incentives to create treatments for those diseases in the future.
So Craig, why don't just step back a second? The prices that we're going to see don't necessarily reflect the sticker prices at the end of the day, right? So there's a lot of negotiation. There's a lot of back and forth between insurance companies, doctors, consumers. What does the increase do actually?
So, I mean, one, it's a input into this negotiation. So it is going to have an effect on the net price that's paid. the actual sort of price the insurer pays. The other thing that's important for pharma is that it is going to affect people, what people spend when they're in their deductible period. So when you're in your deductible period, you pay that list price for the drug. It's going to affect what you pay if you have a percentage-based coinsurance. So if you're on the hook for 20% of the price of the drug, that's 20% of that list price of the drug, and it's going to affect the uninsured. So, I mean, like everything in pharma, it's complicated, but it's not directly the price the insurer pays, but for an increasing fraction of Americans, it is going to be the price they pay for a portion of the year.
Zach, I want to bring you in here for a second. President Trump, as we mentioned, made lowering prescription drug prices a big central argument for his campaign. What has he actually done so far? We've heard a lot of rhetoric, but what's he actually done?
Very little. The rhetoric is really the extent of the policy change we've seen under the Trump administration. A voluntary price freeze from the pharmaceutical industry is a break with recent, very recent history, but the long-term trends haven't changed. The administration had talked about maybe providing a little more transparency in prescription drug ads. So when you see an ad for Humira, for instance, on television, there has to be a little price tag telling people how much this stuff costs. I think the idea there is to sort of shame drug companies into bringing down prices. Because
are they able to be shamed?
It doesn't seem so. High prescription drug prices in the United States are not a secret. We have a scandal of some variety every 6 or 8 months, and the prices keep going up. I mean, I think we can remember a few years ago, EpiPens, I think, more than doubled their price. They're still that high price. They didn't go down because of the public scrutiny. So it's very clear that you have a situation of market failure in the pharmaceutical industry where there is no competitive pressure on these companies, encouraging them to bring down the price of life-saving medicine. And there's no ability for consumers to negotiate down when their lives are on the line.
And let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, why has this been so important for the Trump administration? Why is he sort of latched onto this, even though he hasn't done actually much to change it?
I mean, I find psychoanalyzing the president very difficult, but I will say during his campaign, this did seem like an issue just based on the theater criticism of the rallies and the debates where he actually did seem to care. And you saw it very early in his presidency. I think before he was even in office, he gave a press conference talking about prescription drug prices and how he was going to bring prices down. But he then had a meeting with pharmaceutical executives, and suddenly the agenda went away. And if you look at what the administration has done on trade policy, for instance, it's made NAFTA a top priority for the administration. And there are a lot of critics of NAFTA who'd say on things like labor, he's actually made some progress that I think Democrats and progressives would be enthusiastic about. But the flip side of that has been towing the pharma line on intellectual property. And so he's advocated for or pressed for longer and stronger monopolies on prescription drugs in North America through that policy platform.
Craig, you talked a little bit about the fact that the research that we do in the United States on these drugs is essentially helping drug development across the world. It's giving us access to drugs, improved drugs in the future. But it still seems to be a really literally high price to pay. We just heard a bunch of callers saying that they're spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month on prescription drugs. What would it take, Craig, at a policy level to bring these prices down?
I think we'd have to start making some adult choices about how we want to trade off access today and access later. So I would disagree a bit that there's a market failure here. For brand name drugs, it's not a market failure. It's a policy decision where we provide patents that offer monopolies to drug companies to recoup their R&D costs.
Well, I guess, failure to whom? Is it a failure for the consumer? Is it a failure for the company?
Well, I would note that market failure is a particular term. It's a state that the market's not working, right? That's not what's happening here. It's a choice we've made to provide a monopoly. If we want prices to go down, we've got to be willing to say no to some of these drugs. I said earlier that we have this innovation access trade-off. It might be that we are providing too strong of an incentive for innovation because every new drug that comes out, we're willing to pay for, we pay for, no matter how incrementally improvement. And we might want to say to some of these products, you know, listen, we're not willing to pay for it, and so it's nice that you developed this drug, but it doesn't justify the price you're charging. But that means saying no. It means insurance companies not covering the drug. It means Medicare walking away from an oncology product for cancer if we don't get the price we want. And frankly, as Americans, we don't seem to be willing to do that. That's an adult conversation. That's saying, hey, we're going to provide the right signal to the market. Instead, what we want, what the president is saying, and frankly, Democrats are saying as well, is we're going to get both lower prices and access to all the drugs we want. And that's fantasy land. That's not the world we live in.
This is all based on the assumption that you give monopolies to prescription drug companies in order to create these incentives. These choices are created by the fact that these companies do not have market pressures facing them. And when we talk about market failure in the prescription drug market, we have to talk about the innovations that aren't happening. Doctors will tell you that there is a shortage of antibiotics coming for antibiotic-resistant infections. There isn't enough research going into that area. It's just one example. There's a lot of research going into hair loss drugs. It's not obvious that we need to be spending money on hair loss drugs instead of antibiotic-resistant antibiotics. So there are clearly treatments that we're not getting right now that the market is not addressing. It's difficult to measure that because these things simply don't exist. It's hard to measure something that doesn't exist. But the federal government pays a lot of money for research into pharmaceutical drugs. And pharmaceutical companies essentially take that research over the finish line. And they end up spending more money on marketing than they do on R&D. So the idea that this is the most efficient way to get money into innovation, I think, is a little silly. And when you look at trade policy, where really the front lines of this policy agenda exist, other countries look at the United States and its relationship with the pharmaceutical industry, and it looks corrupt.
I'd like to get your thoughts on that, Craig.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd like to say that it's not based on an assumption that this is the way they do. It's based on pretty solid economic research that what happens is that firms respond to potential profits. I agree we should have more investments in antibiotics, but that just shows that we need to find a way to pay for antibiotics that we want, right? And so what we need to do is we need to be willing to pay for more antibiotics. And I agree completely. I'd like to see things tilted towards that in the market. But the idea that sort of pharmaceutical companies are just at the margin taking products over the line, that the federal government invests a lot of money in R&D, just shows a lack of understanding of how pharmaceutical products come to market.
And I will jump in here. We got about a minute left, and I want to hear from you, Zach, before we wrap here. But I think the question here is that most people would argue, yes, we want innovation. People don't want to be sick and or, you know, saddled with these issues that are requiring these drug prices. But it seems like Americans are still being saddled with the bill. Zach?
I mean, we can have different intellectual property incentives within the monopoly framework. For instance, before 1995, when the WTO treaties were signed, patents were 17 years. WTO made them 20 years. It is not at all obvious that the existing status quo to finance big pharma, essentially, the incentives that Craig is talking about here are just profits. I mean, is there any upward limit at which profits stop incentivizing people? I don't think so. I mean, you could always just say, why not convert all of GDP to the pharmaceutical sector? That's providing more incentive for innovation. We have a history of turning over the levers of public policy to the pharmaceutical industry. They use them to charge higher prices.
Zach Carter is a senior reporter with the Huffington Post, and Craig Garthwaite is the director of healthcare at the Kellogg School of Management. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a European-made language learning program. Babbel teaches practical conversation in Italian, Russian, Swedish, and other languages. Available in the App Store or online at babbel.com.
For some in Washington, the government shutdown is mostly a political game of chicken. But it's a different story on Indian reservations across the country, which often rely on federal dollars to pay police officers or to run schools and hospitals. Russell Begay is the president of the Navajo Nation, and he told us almost every person there has felt the impact of the shutdown.
One big impact that we're already feeling because of the 7, 8, 9, 10 inches of snow that we're experiencing is that the Bureau of Indian Affairs under Department of Interior, they normally maintain the roads. Much of that is dirt road. And a lot of our people living out in the rural areas, they're not able to get out of their homes because the roads are ice-packed and snow-packed. And so our people basically can't get out.
The Navajo Nation is the size of West Virginia and has 350,000 members. 80% of its funding comes from the federal government. So the impact of a shutdown is huge. And Begay says it's an example of the government not holding up its end of the bargain with Native communities.
And we signed a treaty that gave water, natural resources to these cities, to these places, And in exchange, in these treaty agreements, these are contractual agreements that the nation, Navajo Nation, went in with the United States government, is that in return you will get education, health services, economic development, all of those things.
Begay says Indian tribes should not be impacted by the government shutdown because of those treaties. More on that in a moment. But first, I'd like to bring in another Native leader. Aaron Payment is the chairperson of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And he joins the Takeaway from Washington, D.C., where he traveled for the opening of Congress. Aaron, welcome to the Takeaway.
Hello, I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. How is the shutdown impacting your tribe?
So we haven't felt the immediate impact yet, but we do expect to have some drastic choices to make by January 15th if the government doesn't reopen. That's the date in which self-governance contracts will have their next drawdown. And I want to echo President Begay's comments about the treaty and trust responsibility. When we entered these treaties, the federal government obligated itself to provide health, education, and social welfare into perpetuity. And as long as we cannot have our land back, we expect the federal government to fulfill that legal responsibility.
What is it costing you to essentially keep these services that have normally been funded by the federal government open?
Yes, in 2013, the full cost was $1 million. It's about $100,000 per day. So we do have a reserve that keeps us, will carry us through about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks at the most. But then we will feel the pinch and we will have to consider layoffs and furloughs and interruption of services.
I want to bring in one more quote here from Russell Begay of the Navajo Nation. Let's take a listen.
This is an agreement that is higher than agreements between the federal government and states, because this is a treaty. This is a nation-to-nation agreement.
So one of the things, Aaron, is that President Begay there is saying that Indian tribes should be exempt from funding cuts and furloughed employees during the shutdown. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And we do have some congressional leaders who have focused on that. One is Congressman Tom Cole. The other one is Congressman Mark Wayne Mullins. They are both American Indians. They're on the Republican side of the ticket. Today, we will be joined by two Native American women, the first to be elected to Congress, Deborah Holland and Sharice Davids. They're on the Democrat side. And we are nonpartisan. And so we hope that they will help lead consideration of exempting tribes from sequestration, from shutdowns, to make our funding mandatory and also advanced appropriations so that we don't have to borrow in order to operate.
Aaron Payment is the chairperson of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Does what you watch depend on where you live? In October 2018, after the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, comedian Hasan Minhaj released an episode of his Netflix show Patriot Act, and the episode was sharply critical of Saudi Arabia's government. Minhaj specifically called out Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
There are people in Saudi Arabia fighting for true reform, but MBS is not one of them. And to those who continue to work with him, just know that with every deal you close, you are simply helping entrench an absolute monarch under the guise of progress, because ultimately, MBS is not modernizing Saudi Arabia. The only thing he's modernizing is Saudi dictatorship.
Netflix has since pulled the episode from its site in Saudi Arabia. The move came at the request of the Saudi government, who told Netflix the episode violated one of the country's cybercrime laws. Netflix's decision is drawing criticism on social media, but it's only the latest example of a U.S.-based company complying with an authoritarian regime. Jillian York is a director for international freedom of expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, an organization that promotes civil liberties. Thanks for being with us, Jillian.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I'm just curious. This is content and a show. It's a U.S.-based company. Hasan Minhaj is a U.S.-based comedian. This is content that is distributed, you know, based in the and created in the United States. Now, doesn't Saudi Arabia and other countries, don't they have the option to determine what their own citizens see?
They do have that option, and I think that that's the sort of premise that Netflix is operating on. But at the same time, we're talking about a country that currently has several women in prison simply for the act of daring to drive or to record women driving, even though that happened just before the law was overturned. We're talking about a country that has murdered a journalist recently with impunity. And so personally, you know, I would put human rights above sovereignty in this instance.
But is it Netflix's responsibility to operate under that framework?
Legally, they have every right to comply with this order. And in fact, they might argue that they have to as a platform that has Saudi customers. But morally speaking, they could choose not to operate in that country altogether. And I think that that might be the right moral choice.
And in terms of the segment itself, I mean, we saw Hisham Minhaj tweet that, and I'm quoting here, clearly the best way to stop people from watching something is to ban it, make it trend online, and then leave it up on YouTube, was his response. The question I have is, I mean, is he essentially right? I mean, can't people find workarounds anyway?
Yes, absolutely. And so this is a common effect where we see content that is removed by platforms replicated on other platforms, and you know, it becomes more desirable to the people who are being banned from seeing it. So in this case, although Netflix does, generally speaking, block most VPNs, making it difficult for people to get around it and access another country's version of Netflix, this video in particular has already popped up on YouTube as well as some of the other less popular streaming sites.
What are really the concerns that you have about this particular move? Because I'm thinking, what could Netflix have done? Could they have pulled the entire series, thereby losing more viewers potentially than they would have just for that one episode? What is it that they're supposed to do? What are tech companies supposed to do when they're operating internationally?
It is quite a tricky issue, but at the same time, overall, I would say that when companies agree to take down content at the behest of governments, what we typically see is more governments following suit. So if you look at the transparency reports of major companies such as Google and Facebook, just a few years ago, we were only seeing requests from a handful of countries, some of the worst actors like Turkey. Nowadays, we're seeing requests for content takedowns from a number of different places, including a pretty growing number of democracies. And so I think that this is a trend that we should really be concerned about, and that companies should take great care when deciding where to open an office. When we see companies increasingly open offices in places like the UAE or Turkey, countries that really have very little regard for freedom of expression, I think that that poses a great risk overall across the entire internet to free speech.
Jillian York is a director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Jillian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We reached out to Netflix about this story, and they sent us this comment in response. Quote, we strongly support artistic freedom worldwide and removed this episode only in Saudi Arabia after we had received a valid legal demand from the government and to comply with local law. Netflix might be acquiescing to the Saudi government, but the streaming giant is also trying to exert its influence across the African continent.
I'm here to let everybody know that I will be starring in Africa's very first Netflix original. Whew, I can't believe I'm saying this.
That was South African actress and ABC's Quantico alum Pearl Tusi announcing to her Twitter followers that she will be starring in Queen Sono, a Netflix original about a cross-continental spy.
It shows that Netflix is taking Africa as a market more seriously. And what that indicates is to other players in the streaming business that this is a market that has long been ignored and should be taken more seriously.
That's Lindsay Schutel, a correspondent for Quartz in Johannesburg, South Africa.
For African viewers in particular, who have spent a lifetime watching American and European series, particularly American series, for them it's affirming to see their own stories on television. So this has an impact both culturally, but also just in terms of the business of streaming.
Lindsay says in choosing South Africa as its first production site and this intercontinental story, Netflix signals it has bigger plans ahead.
Africa has the youngest population. We're having something of a population boom where in certain parts of the continent, the average age is 16 and the oldest is South Africa, which is the average age is about 25. So that's a market you really want to get in on as soon as possible. But this is also a market that is seeing the continent change in real time, thanks to things like smartphones. So we just had we've had massive change in the last decade or so. And so this is a market who are young, who are practically attached to their cell phones, just like any other group of young people. And they're a group of young people who will, the assumption is that they will have money to spend. And so if you already, like Netflix, have a presence here, then you're able to then get in on that market really, really quickly.
I'm wondering if we could talk money also, Lindsay. I'm wondering how big of a production is this going to be and whether or not we know anything about, you know, the thing that always gets talked about when we start production is who's getting paid what. So are there any big payouts coming?
As always, Netflix has been quite, they've kept the numbers quite close to their chest. And even the production company, who I asked, and they're not sharing any numbers as well. So we don't know how much Netflix is spending on this just yet. We don't know how much the stars involved are getting paid, as well as the production company, unfortunately. I'm imagining that because South Africa has a cheaper film industry, that I imagine that this would be a cheaper series to make than most of Netflix's originals. But again, we'd have to wait and see until Netflix eventually releases those numbers.
Well, of course, there's also the added issue of actually getting people to see this. We talked a little bit about the growth in technology, particularly mobile technology on the continent. But I'm wondering, is there enough technology, i.e. reliable internet, Wi-Fi, and really strong infrastructure in order for Netflix to distribute the content?
I mean, and that's exactly an issue. I understand that South Africa, where I'm speaking to you from right now, has a far more advanced view than the rest of the continent. But we are seeing fast internet growth among other countries. For example, Ethiopia, Rwanda all have pretty fast internet connections. The problem is, of course, that the number of people with access to that internet is still quite slow. And the number of people who can afford a smartphone is not growing as fast as was expected. And what most people are using here is something of a feature phone, the old feature phones that we had that can still play video, but to a far less extent than a smartphone. And also we're seeing cell phone companies producing phones, particularly for the African market, where there's somewhere between a smartphone and a feature phone, as in a feature phone that has some of the capabilities of a smartphone. And those are really picking up among young people. But we're also seeing that, as I said earlier, that Netflix is really taking this market, the developing world as a market, seriously. So I, for example, can watch a Netflix show on a slower bandwidth, and the quality is not that terribly different. And what it does is that it reduces the data usage. Because what happens is in Africa, because most of our data is used by mobile, we still have to buy per gig. It's not unlimited, as people have come to expect in developed countries. So Netflix has considered that fact. The only problem is that internet is still particularly expensive. So I do know that Netflix is currently testing in Malaysia a subscription service, a tailor-made subscription service that costs less than your average $10 Netflix subscription. A lower usage and a lower quality, but it is available for that particular market. So it makes it easier for Malaysians to be able to watch Netflix, and makes it easier for them to compete against platforms like YouTube, which are free. But I suspect that Netflix will at some point also pilot this project in African countries, this lower subscription.
I'm wondering, what has the reaction been on the ground to this Netflix announcement? Are people excited for the attention? Are they excited for the potential to shift narratives? Or are they concerned that this might not be something that they're looking forward to?
So there are two schools of thought to that. It depends on where you are. So audiences are pretty excited because, you know, with this, you know, people who watch Netflix in Johannesburg, in South Africa, and elsewhere in the continent are also kids who are on, and I shouldn't really say kids because it's all of us, we're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. So we're seeing real-time conversations about shows that are happening in the US. So before, like maybe a decade ago, where a film would take 3 to 6 months to arrive in Africa, it's now immediate. And Africans, it's almost immediate in most cases. And Africans expect to be part of those conversations. They also want to tweet. They also want to Instagram. Like just this last weekend, I think it was the film Bird Box. That got as much interest on social media in South Africa as it did abroad. So now Africans get to be part of this global conversation. It may not be an earth-shattering conversation. It's just, you know, maybe Bird Box memes, but that's important because it shows that there's a global community happening here. The other thing is that what Netflix has done in South Africa is that they've hired well-known South Africans. There are huge billboards all over Johannesburg and Cape Town with Trevor Noah's Netflix special. So there's a real push to get the South African market and to embrace Netflix. However, Netflix's competition here in South Africa, which would be MultiChoice or DStv, is a satellite subscription subscription channel that is not just South Africa, but Africa's biggest entertainment platform, and they're quite threatened by Netflix. MultiChoice and DStv now believe that Netflix is targeting them, so much so that the CEO complained that Netflix is actually putting up billboards and signs nearby their Johannesburg headquarters. And so DStv feels that this is a personal slight towards them. So there's a real, on both sides, audiences are excited and Netflix's competition, quite frankly, is spooked.
Lindsay Schutel is Johannesburg correspondent for Quartz. Lindsay, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.